From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Whatever happened to manly men? The Marlboro Man has given way to the metrosexual, and TV is full of doofus dads. Men in general may be in cultural decline. Today, do we need to save the males? Kathleen Parker thinks so.
Anybody who has a little boy will quickly see that our culture is particularly hostile and applauds that hostility toward the male, and you can't abide it. You have to say, look, we don't want to be that kind of people. We don't want to have this kind of culture.
More from Kathleen Parker in just a moment. Also, the rise of men's culture. We'll get a taste of fratire from the author of The Alphabet of Manliness.
I is for irate. Irate is man's default and only emotion. Men are always irate, sometimes for good reason and sometimes for no reason at all.
And the no-holds-barred comedy of Chris Farley, Chippendales dancer, Bears fan, and hungry Gap girl.
Cindy, can you leave some for us?
I thought you were trying to lose weight.
Lay off me, I'm starving!
According to cultural provocateur Kathleen Parker, men are under siege, along with fatherhood and maleness in American culture. Parker says that feminism went astray, and instead of seeking power for women, it made men the enemy. Her new book is called Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. Kathleen Parker talked to Anne Strainchamps.
My ultimate goal here, of course, is to save men so that women have someone with whom to mate, marry, and raise the next generation. If you have only highly educated, well-qualified women, then I don't know who they're going to marry. Somebody once asked Harvey Mansfield that question. You know, he wrote the book Manliness. And with a completely straight face, he said, well, they're going to have to marry criminals. So let me just use that as my prefatory remark. Then let's look at some of the many, many signals that men, and particularly young boys and young men, get in the culture. I mean, if you just look at the television programming, for example, and the sitcoms, you know, the guy is always portrayed as an idiot. I mean, I get so much email from men who are so fed up with this that they feel, you know, is there any guy out there who has a clue? You know, you're either a doofus or a pedophile or a deadbeat or a wife beater. You know, it's just negative, 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 negative.
And you think the women come off as better?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely they do. Women are often portrayed as sort of more competent. And, of course, I joke with my girlfriends that this is, of course, true, but what you have to consider is not so much that one little sitcom is damaging. It is actually intended to be entertaining. But I think if you look at the larger picture, if that's all you're getting, if that's all that's being communicated, that gradually that image infiltrates the zeitgeist and just becomes part of a broader understanding that men are less competent and less honorable and less reliable than women.
Right before we move away from media, because I know you cover a lot of ground, I'm just curious, what do you make of, for instance, all the movies in which men are heroes and save the world from the forces of evil and the women are arm candy?
Well, I can't give you a statistic off the top of my head as to whether there is a balance there, but I think women are objectified in ways that are not attractive and that are not positive for girls, too. But I'm making a case for guys. This is the point of view that I took for this particular book. Now, I will say this, you know, there are people who have done studies about how the mass media messages convey men. And let me just say this. I know, for example, there was one, and all this is in the book, but I can't give you the exact numbers. I think there were 104 television programs in which a father was present. And only 4 out of that 104 was the father portrayed in a positive way. Mm. Now, you've got little boys growing up in a world, and girls too. I mean, I don't mean to say this is not harmful. I think it's harmful to girls as well. But you have boys and girls growing up without fathers in too many cases. I mean, almost a third of children grow up without a dad in the home, their own dad, that is. And so what they see only the dad is portrayed on television. Well, what are little girls and little boys supposed to think about what a father is and what he looks like and how he behaves? And I'm just suggesting that these kids aren't getting much in the way of positive role models.
I'm the mother of a little boy, too, and feel the same way about what I want for him in the world and in the future. I'm wondering whether some of that hostility you're picking up on that women have for men has partly to do with some of the changes that we've made in the world and in the workplace. You know, study after study shows that women are doing more juggling than men are. You know, we won the right to go to work, and to have careers, but somehow we've still got the majority of raising the family and taking care of the housework on our plates also. And I think an awful lot of women do legitimately feel resentful about that.
Well, my position on that is women and men can figure this out. You know, we're not babies, and we don't need studies and manifestos to help us figure out how to divvy up the work. I mean, if your husband's not doing his share, then don't do it. You know, sit down. I don't know what you do, but you talk about it. My husband and I do everything. We're equal partners, but that doesn't mean we don't have a flow chart in the kitchen that says, okay, I did the dishes today, you do the dishes tomorrow. If you get right down to it, those studies rarely take into account the things that men do that women typically don't do, whether it's taking out the garbage or doing the yard work or doing the plumbing or doing the repairs. I hear from men all the time who feel like, wait a minute, I take the kid out and throw the ball with him. Why doesn't that count? You know, it's not housework per se, as we've always thought of it, but it's part of child rearing. You know, I guess it looks like the guys are doing all the fun things, but in fact, the guys are doing what guys do well. I mean, men, fathers, you know, they tend to be the ones who encourage their kids to do riskier behaviors, while moms tend to be the ones who say, no, 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 you know, get off that wall. I've seen this in my own life. But we don't credit that. We don't, you know, we want to quantify everything according to numbers of hours spent and results seen. And the truth is, fathers, good fathers, I'm not talking about bad men here, good fathers do a lot of things that are not calculated in those studies that are equally valuable. They're just not the same.
You're concerned especially about boys and young men who are growing up in this kind of atmosphere. Could we talk some about classroom and what's going on there? Because that's another area that you've looked at. You know, for years we were told there was a huge, huge gender gap between girls and boys in terms of math and science. And I think it's still there, though maybe narrowed some. But what do you see going on in the classroom?
Well, it's definitely narrowing. Girls are catching up to boys in nearly every respect. I think they're still slightly behind in the math and sciences, but they're way, way ahead of boys in reading and writing. And, of course, in an information age, that's a great advantage when it comes to the job market. But, you know, we went through this stage about late 80s, I guess, where we decided that girls were suffering this great self-esteem crisis. And we wanted to adjust things so that the classroom was more female-friendly. I don't get this. I mean, I grew up at a time when boys were wildly waving their hands and girls were sitting more quietly. But, you know, I don't think anybody felt thwarted. I mean, I'm one of those women. It certainly didn't hold me back. Hillary Clinton didn't get held back by boys who were more aggressive in classrooms. But the trickle-down effect of this idea that somehow girls had to be coddled a little bit more in class, or that may not be the right word, but had to be dealt with in a different way, well, the result has been that girls are doing better and boys are falling behind. We also did some adjusting to the curriculum that I think has been maybe better for girls but not so good for boys, simply because guys don't have anything, they're not interested in the reading material, for example. The books are in the middle schools, the young adult literature has to do with issues that girls tend to be more tuned into, relationships, social problems. You know, there's no emphasis anymore on the books that little boys grew up with when I was coming along, heroism, valor, courage, you know, the heroes that were sort of common fare once upon a time are no longer available, or certainly not as popular. And so by high school, boys have just stopped reading altogether, and they're dropping out at astronomical rates. And so we end up with this imbalance. Now, I'm not suggesting, and no one is suggesting, that we change the curriculum so that it's more boy-friendly. It's simply a matter of pulling back and saying, look, this should not be a zero-sum game. We need to do whatever works and find out those things that will help boys do well so that these very accomplished young ladies have somebody to talk to.
As boys and girls begin to grow up and hit the middle school and then the high school age, it's hard to have a girl and not be aware of, I think, what you call slut culture around us. You know, there's just a lot of in-your-face, very revealing clothing, sort of attitudes on television and in the mass media that make a lot of parents uncomfortable. What do you make of that, that we've got a culture that seems to both denigrate men and also view women as sexual objects?
Well, it's extremely disturbing. I feel sorry for parents of daughters right now who are trying to raise them, you know, with healthy attitudes toward sex and toward their own bodies and their own self-image. But I also hear, I hear from mothers all the time that they can't find clothes for little girls that aren't revealing. And this is, again, it's the Sex and the City trickle down, I guess. But the idea that, you know, we've sexualized everything in this culture, and it's unfortunately trickled down to these younger and younger ages, so that you now have cute little T-shirts for babies that say, I faked it, or, you know, I'm a porn star. And it's, you know, it's multifaceted, right? It's the pornification of the culture, where we've mainstreamed all sex all the time. And the girls see these women having such fun with their revealing clothes and their Manolos and just sleeping around and trying to find the right guy. The hookup culture, I mean, it's just on and on and on. There's so many different factors. And yes, we denigrate men and we sexualize women. And then we want men to treat girls with respect. And we have girls who think that hooking up with some random guy, doing a booty call or, friends with benefit, fits as cool and fun. You know, this has all just crept up on us. I don't think any one thing is to blame. It's the whole culture.
You know, I'm wondering, if you take the long view of the gender wars, you know, back over the centuries, you know, there's always been this long rivalry between men and women, and men had the upper hand for centuries. You know, it's within living memory that women were able to own property and vote. So, I mean, what's wrong with thinking that if women are coming into more power now, maybe it's simply part of this gradual process of equalization, and in the end, you know, where we'll arrive is a place where both men and women can be free to determine their own paths and their own identities.
Taking the long view, I agree with you, and I think probably that's exactly what we're seeing. This is that staticky period where women finally have power, and we're getting more. The question is, how do you use that power? How do you wield it? Are you equally abusive? Do you become the worst man you ever knew? Or do you recognize that there is a responsibility that comes with power? And anybody who has a little boy will quickly see that the world is, that our culture is particularly hostile and applauds that hostility toward the male. And you can't abide it. You have to say, look, we don't want to be that kind of people. We don't want to have this kind of culture. And so women, maybe we show men that this is how you do it.
Is there something more at stake for you here? Because I think you write near the end of your book that you're very concerned that the gender wars, as you've described them, are destabilizing the American family and leaving it vulnerable.
Well, I do think that. And part of this radical feminization or radical feminism has been to applaud also the idea that fathers are not necessary, men are not necessary. And we've gone to a great deal of trouble, by the way, to prove that. It's not simply a matter of Hallmark cards and television programs. We have social scientists conducting studies trying to prove that men are not necessary. And then the media hops on and says, you know, we make single motherhood into kind of a higher level of evolution almost, where, look, guys aren't necessary to this process. We can do this by ourselves. We have all the goods, and now we have the money. We don't need them. Again, this is an overreaction to what you've described as this sort of historical imbalance. But where does that get us? You've got unwed mothers who are not really, you know, we're not all Murphy Browns out there. We don't all have the financial and social support that we need to actually do the hard work of raising children. And that's the part of the story that doesn't get told. I mean, fathers are not just, you know, a vial of genetic material. They bring special skills to the table. The ideal situation is a mother and a father and a cohesive family. And I should know, because I grew up without one of those. And I know that children really do seek that. They seek that predictable kind of, the kind of thing that makes us all feel, you know, angst and ennui is the very thing that children desperately want.
Kathleen Parker is the author of Save the Males, Why Men Matter, Why Women Should Care. She spoke with Ann Strangechamps.
What do you
you think of the Save the Males movement? Are men an endangered species? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, Tom Farley shares memories of his brother, Chris Farley, the late great star of Saturday Night Live and movies. Also, the alphabet of manliness and the fratire movement as we continue to explore what it means to be a man today. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Farley Jr. is the co-author, along with Tanner Colby, of The Chris Farley Show, a biography in three acts. It's an oral biography of the actor and comedian Chris Farley, who was a star on Saturday Night Live and in three straight number one hit movies. Farley died of the effects of substance abuse in 1997. He was 33. Tom Farley is also Chris Farley's older brother. Although Chris Farley's work can be considered frat comedy, he never belonged to a fraternity at Marquette, as Tom Farley explains.
They didn't have frats. They had a house that acted like an animal house. But yeah, Jesuit schools don't do the frat thing very well. But you got to understand that Chris didn't start drinking till he was halfway through 17, almost 18 years old, which was the legal drinking age here in Wisconsin at the time.
There's a bit in your book, when he started drinking, he went all the way. He
had, it was like noticeable.
10
right?
shots of tequila or something on the first night he ever tasted alcohol.
You can pinpoint the moment he started drinking, and it also you can pinpoint when it started to become a problem immediately. I mean, it was just that way. But, you know, Chris was funny for 17 years of his life without alcohol, and he wasn't as funny to be around and fun to be around when he was really in the heat of it in his college years. And then when he got to SNL and he found sobriety. When he found sobriety, he was back on top, and that's when he created all these amazing characters.
Now, as your father probably told you, my name is Matt Foley, and I am a motivational speaker. Now, let's get started by letting me give you a little bit of a scenario of what my life is all about. First off, I am 35 years old. I am divorced, and I live in a van down by the river.
Chris's humor was always very appealing to young men, and I guess you can see that. It was it's guy humor.
Totally.
Did it appeal to young women?
I saw this so many times. Again, I go back to this ability to communicate and connect to people using his humor. I illustrate that by talking about stand-up comedians who, when they're heckled from the crowd, you know, their natural human response is to get defensive and go right back at that person. Chris was not like that. He never used his humor destructively.
Except maybe toward himself. He was a very self-deprecating.
Oh, no question. Yeah, I see him so many times, you know, when we were in college at the local bar, and he'd walk up to a booth full of sorority girls, and, you know, one or two may have thought he was funny. There was always one girl that just didn't buy his humor at all. And instead of being, you know, defensive and cutting this person down, he would just, he was relentless, and he would, you know, hit the ground and do one-arm Rocky push-ups and pop back up and pull his shirt over his head. And all of a sudden, you just see the smirk come on the girl's face. And it was just good-hearted. I'm not, you know, and just was just goofy humor. And even girls would eventually come around and smirk. And once Chris saw that smirk, he was gone to the next booth. You know, that's all he needed. He just needed that approval.
Some of that is, and it's interesting hearing about it, because it sounds as though he was sort of in need of approval.
Oh, all the time.
And he was willing to be self-deprecating.
Well,
The Chippendales.
Chippendales. Yeah, there's the book is
Saturday
great. The book is great, talking about how the different analysis of that moment. And
well, for anybody who hasn't seen it,
I mean, he's here. He is shirtless as a Chippendales dancer next to Patrick Swayze, who was just chiseled.
Right.
And
Chris wasn't chiseled.
No.
He's a little overweight at that
point. As we called it early on in life, husky.
Barney, we all agreed that your dancing was great. Your presentation was very sexy. I guess in the end, we all thought that Adrian's body was just much, much better than yours.
Okay.
You see, it's just that at Chippendales, our dancers have traditionally had that lean, muscular, healthy physique, like Adrian's. Whereas yours is, well, fat and flabby.
Right, right.
Do you remember the first time you saw that?
I was there at the show.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was there.
What'd you think?
I had seen that act, Chris play that act, since I was a kid. I mean, in our living room, when we were in college, you know, we'd be up at Northern Wisconsin. We were camp counselors in college. And, you know, we'd be out at night in the local tavern, and the band was there, and they'd go on break. The dance floor would clear off, and we'd look around, and there'd be Chris by himself with his shirt off, just doing this routine and just cracking us up. And so, I mean, you really can't define Chris in your terms. Chris Rock, you know, thought it was not the right thing for Chris to do, but...
Well, yeah, in the book, you quote Chris Rock as saying he thought that was sad.
Yeah, he said an altogether Chris Farley would not have done that. And yet, if it was, you know, somewhat racial, would Chris Rock have done an act like that? Absolutely not. Chris Farley was willing to do that because, you know, that was his defense for years. On the playground, you had to be extremely quick to beat Chris to the punch by calling him fatso. Chris got it out of the way, and not only did he get it out, it was almost challenging to an adversary, saying, all right, yeah, I'm fat, and now what are you going to say? It was almost, he had that Cyrano kind of, you know, what are you going to do now? And then he would, all of a sudden, this adversary, who was declawed, he would start to make him laugh. And all of a sudden, this person that came at Chris with malice was laughing with him.
Yeah.
And it was incredible to see that, the ability for Chris to change that by... this self-deprecating humor, yeah. And it was...
I suppose. I mean, Chris Rock said, I think, and I've got the quote here, it was as though the joke said, we can't hire you because you're fat. Well, it's a funny thing in a way, isn't it? Because he got hired in part because he was fat.
Yeah.
And was willing to make fun of himself.
Sure.
For being fat.
Didn't think the suits would have me back, perhaps. Thought they'd have my derriere replaced by one of those cookie-cutter store mannequins. Well, maybe I'm not the norm. I'm not camera friendly. I don't wear clothes that fit me. I'm not a heartbreaker. I haven't had sex with a woman. I don't know how that works. I guess I don't fall in line.
At one point in the book, you say, Chris could never be content with his professional success. Because he was living by Dad's barometer and not his own.
Dad gave us faith and this love of our culture and heritage and community here in Wisconsin and Madison. I mean, he really embodied that, all of that. And we, all of us, took that, and it's a big part of who we are. But there was something deeper with Chris and Dad. They both, you know, abused alcohol, and they were both quite large. And yet... you know, Dad was, all, you know, a large guy, and yet, you know, he was always impeccably dressed. He was, you know, always looked sharp, and we were always, and we revered him. He was so funny and so good. And yet we were always saying, Dad looks great. Doesn't he look great? And we were always avoiding that, this whole health issue that he had. And Chris, more than anybody, was there saying the same things. And it must have been, for somebody overweight himself, must have thought, well, how is Dad looking great? And I feel like I feel horrible. I mean, how can I trust people to, you know, to tell me I'm good when I've lived this life of, you know, I could so visually, you know, under the surface, you know, see that there isn't that truth.
He died in 1997?
Yeah, at the very end, December.
Do you remember? How did you learn of his death?
Wow. Yeah, I was living out in Connecticut at the time, and... was at a friend's, and we were talking about some business deals that we wanted to explore. And he had a TV on in his office, and CNN was on. It was muted, and I saw a clip from Chris and Spade, one of the movies. And And I thought, oh, wow, what's Chris up to? You know, it was kind of, you know, that was life with, you know, a celebrity brother. It's like, you know, you learn on TV a lot of things. But so I said, turn it up. Let's see what's happening. And then it immediately went to, you know, outside his apartment with the ambulance. And they talk about, you know, it's almost like, did they just say Chris was dead? What? I didn't believe it. And I was listening to this, like, and my friend just kind of, you know, gave me the phone and said, you know,
take call home.
Yeah. And I called, and as soon as, you know, my dad picked up the phone and heard his voice, and it was, that was it. I knew exactly. He came crashing home.
Yeah. Well, for your family, and the legacy has been in some ways recovery, because there were other members of the family who were having trouble.
Yeah. You know, and for us, it wasn't really about addiction. It was just about, do we need this in our lives? And one by one, we all kind of addressed that.
Even your dad?
Even my father. My dad was the only one that decided to get sober after Chris had died. Every one of us before that, we saw the pain that the alcohol was bringing to Chris and the people around him, but we also saw how successful Chris was without it in his life. It was that light bulb moment in all of us at different times that, you know, maybe I can be a little bit more successful if I didn't have this, you know, this weight around my ankles all the time. And so my mom was the first, you know, now it's been almost 20 years, I think, and Kevin, Johnny, and then myself. I wish, you know, Chris had seen more times like that. Chris was 100%, 100% of the time. It was just all the time.
What you see is what you get.
Except for when he was in the comfort zone of his faith or a few of those people that, you know, he always kept his Madison friends very close out in New York, a few of them from home. And in those few instances, he opened up. That was a whole different, and I saw it firsthand for myself when he was my best man at my wedding. Frightening as that was to me, he was my only choice. So here we were, like, seconds before, and we're kind of waiting for the show to start, and Chris has me in the sacristy in the back room of the church. I was so nervous, and he just had me in stitches, just putting me through jumping jacks and, you know, like a coach was, and he was, you know, giving me this whole, like, it was a football game. And then we walked out onto the altar, and the guy just changed. He just had this pious look. And I remember looking at him like, you know, wow, what happened there? I mean, and
who's
I,
this?
And he, yeah, it's like, who is this guy? And he got me to go the same direction. You know, he totally loosened me up, and then he had me in the mindset of this, you know, religious ceremony. It was like, that was Chris. That was totally Chris.
If only.
Well, you know, the beauty of this book is that, again, I knew that I couldn't survive on the clips from SNL. I say it in the book, you know, right after Chris died, I looked at my wife, and my biggest fear was being 60 years old and trying to remember who this kid was that was my little brother. You know, Matt Foley wasn't going to do it for me. That's why I love this book, and I love it because it's not just me. It's all these voices, and they've given me this picture of Chris, and all of us, really, this picture of Chris that is the real deal. That's him.
I think we've got time for one more question. Hey, remember when you were in the Beatles and you did that album, Abbey Road, and at the very end of the song, it goes, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. You remember that?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes, Chris. In my experience, it is. I find the more you give, the more you get.
It's a clip of Chris Farley with Paul McCartney from Saturday Night Live. Tom Farley Jr. is Chris Farley's older brother. Tom Farley is also the co-author, along with Tanner Colby, of The Chris Farley Show, a biography in three acts. Tom Farley is the president and managing director of the Chris Farley Foundation. It educates young people about substance abuse and addiction.
You can find a link to the Chris Farley Foundation's website on our website at ttbook.org. F is for female wrestling, N is for Chuck Norris, and R is for road rage. It's according to the Alphabet of Manliness. The Alphabet of Manliness is the best-selling book by one of the founding fathers of fratire, Maddox. Maddox talked to Steve Paulson about this new literary genre.
The conventional wisdom in literature, in the publishing industry, actually, is that men don't buy books. And there's a pretty good reason for that, and it's because they don't publish very many books that men are interested in. In fact, before my book came out, the only other book that kind of addressed this topic and this audience was a book written in 1998 by the Hoffman brothers called The Big Damn Book of Sheer Manliness. And I think 8 years is an awfully long time to go without any other major publications that address this audience.
How would you describe this audience for what you describe as manliness?
Well, until I went out and actually did my book tour, I had no idea what the majority of my fans looked like. And it turns out that they are people who play video games. The average age, I would say, is early 20s, you know, some college. People who work regular jobs, but they're not too invested in their jobs. Like people like me when I was working at my old job.
Now, are these all guys who read you?
About 40% of my readership is women, surprisingly, because a lot of my writing is very misogynistic. But I think the women who read it know that it's tongue-in-cheek, and they get the humor. They're smart. Of course, I have a large percentage of women and men, actually, who read my website and get very offended by it and send me hate mail, which makes for some of the best reading on my website.
So you deliberately court this kind of hate mail, and you're not shy about saying that there's a lot of women hating in what you write.
Sure. Yeah. And sometimes I get asked about that. Specifically, I did an interview a little while back, I think, with Salon, and they asked me why it's okay to make fun of women in this book as opposed to races. But there are a lot of different categories of people I make fun of in this book, specifically children and old people, anorexic people, people with attention deficit disorder, and other men, in fact. And I think it's a little bit sexist, frankly, to just single out women as not being okay to make fun of.
Well, just to give people a taste of what you've done in this book, The Alphabet of Manliness, you've arranged it in chapter order. A is for ass-kicking, B, boner, C is for copping a feel, D, dump, taking a, E, enlightenment, F, female wrestling. I guess not exactly very highbrow here, is it?
No, this is the type of book I think that, well, I thought when I was writing it, I wanted to cast a very large net to catch as many people, and I think this is probably the way to do it. It's not necessarily the book I would have written if I could have written any book, but I knew this type of book would have been a commercial success, because essentially an alphabet is a list, and people love reading lists. If you've ever been to a website like dig.com, almost every single article on there is top 10 something.
Your writing, along with the writing of some other people like Tucker Max, has been described as fratire. What do you make of that label?
I don't like it, and Tucker doesn't like it at all. Neither of us were in frats in college. In fact, I think I'm pretty much the type of guy I would have been bullied by some of the frat guys. But I guess this type of writing and this genre needed a label, and it stuck.
Mm-hmm. Now, you seem to take deliberate delight in not being PC, not being sensitive or genteel or anything like that. Did you just get bored with that kind of stuff? Do you just reject that out of hand?
That has something to do with it, but I never write anything to be shocking just for the sake of being shocking. It's really easy to be shocking. You can say something that's very offensive, but there's a kernel of truth in the things that I say, which makes it a little bit more compelling than just coming out and saying something offensive. Like, for example, in my book, in the Enlightenment section, I was kind of joking around when I was writing that chapter about how there are no female inventions, and then actually did some research, and I thought, maybe I should back this up, and I found that there were very, very few female inventors or female inventions that were created by females, and so that kind of adds an edge to it. It's not just that I'm being misogynistic here, but I am kind of addressing this great lapse in female inventors.
How do you explain that? Because, I mean, women are just treated as, you know, as sex objects, as, you know, you got to push them around, you know, they're irritating and all that. Why would 40% of your readers be women?
Well, I think they're okay with it because the truth is that women have a lot of power in society. I know there's still a lot of, you know, there's still a ways to go for equality. But if you look at statistics in college, women are dominating men almost 2-1 in a lot of campuses. With degrees, women are getting more and more competitive pay. And also, women love to cite statistics like women make only 70 cents to the dollar that every man makes. But I did some research about that, and it's really hard to find where that study came from. The closest I found was a women's group who sponsored the study, but you don't find any details about that study. And I was thinking about it. If that were true, then why wouldn't employers overwhelmingly hire women if they could simply pay them less? Because obviously, a lot of corporations are willing to break the law and hire illegal immigrants for the sake of paying them less. So why not women?
So you're suggesting that a lot of your female readers agree with your social commentary?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's tongue-in-cheek, but also it's not so offensive because women are stronger. It's like making a racial joke about whites as opposed to any other ethnicity or minority group that might be marginalized in society. The stronger that group becomes, the more acceptable it becomes to make fun of them.
Now, obviously, a lot of this is tongue-in-cheek. A satire, I guess, would be the obvious phrase to describe your writing.
Sure.
But I'm guessing there are a number of people who would sort of take this more literally. I mean, do you worry about some of these guys who would actually agree with all the things you're saying?
Yeah, actually, there have been a couple. There was someone who came to me on my book tour who said that his friend was reading the book in a classroom and the teacher asked him to put it away. And he said he refused to put it away and the teacher asked him again and I guess he threw it at her or something like that. He ended up going to some kind of juvenile court or something like that. Yeah, there are those people, but I'm not too worried about that because they're the same people who are going to be inspired by a slasher film to go out and kill somebody. I mean, these are very few, very far between.
Now, I'd like to get another taste of your book. And frankly, there are a number of chapters that I can't even ask you to read because I don't think it would work very well on the radio. But you do have J is for Beef Jerky. Could you read the beginning of that?
Sure. If someone invented a way to package sex and put it straight into your mouth, it would taste like beef jerky. When I was 6 years old, friends and family were shocked when I woke up one day and had a full-grown beard. My voice was deeper, my hands were calloused, and my balls dangled like pendulums. Doctors diagnosed me with precarious puberty, a condition that causes the early onset of puberty. Nobody knew why I was afflicted with this abnormality until they finally traced it to a manliness gene triggered by the manliest food in the universe, beef jerky. If there is a food out there that's manlier than strips of flesh ripped from an animal's ribs, cured, smoked, and flavored so it can be slammed down the throats of hungry construction workers, I'd like to know what it is.
And how far do you think this whole sensibility, and particularly this kind of writing, can go in our culture? Are we just seeing the beginning of it?
I think so. You're seeing just the beginning of it, but it's probably not going to last for more than about 10 years because, like old trends, they go away eventually. And in a way, I think this is a backlash to metrosexualism and how cool it's been, really, to be androgynous in a way in our society. There's not really that strong voice of manliness that existed in our father's generations. Like my dad, for example, we went fishing one time and he caught a fish and he didn't have anything to gut it with, so he bit the fish's guts out, which is just ultra manly. And his hands are just calloused and gross and rough. And my hands are comparatively pretty smooth because all I do is type. My dad works with metal and chainsaws and wood, and I work with plastic and monitors.
You're saying he bit the guts out?
Yeah, he bit the fish's guts and spit it out.
So that's the kind of guy that you look up to.
Well, it's a kind of guy that doesn't really exist very much anymore. A lot of people work with computers in cubicles, and that type of man is disappearing. So it's kind of a callback to our father's generations.
Now, I read somewhere that you actually started out writing your blog when you're living in your parents' basement in Utah. What do they think of what you're doing?
The first time my mom read my website, she cried. There's actually a quote on the back of my book. It's an actual quote from my mom. She says, I didn't raise you like this. Why are you like this? Your father's not like this either. This is terrible. So my mom wasn't... Actually, when I told my mom that I got a book deal, the first thing she told me was to go back to school and get a real job.
Maddox is the author of The Alphabet of Manliness. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of the idea of a politically incorrect literary genre designed to appeal to young men? You can share your thoughts by sending an email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, a young girl growing up in East L.A., dreaming of a career in the man sport of boxing, as we conclude our hour on what it means to be a man. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Irsi Arvizu has been making music for quite a while. She had a number three hit in 1964 with her sisters, and she spent many years fronting bands, including Latin rock giants El Chicano. Yet Arvizu has just now released her debut solo album. It's called Friend for Life, and it was produced by the well-known guitarist, singer, and composer Rye Cooter. The songs are very autobiographical. On the opening track, Windows of Dreams, Arvizu reminisces about being a young girl with a passion for a man's sport.
I sat on my milk crate, made some holes in the wall, wondering what went on the other side. I sat there and watched the boys go by. They all shared the same dream. They all wanted a better life. Boxing was a ticket to riches and fame. My father was a trainer, one by one they came. I wasn't allowed in this man's world. The holes in the wall became my windows of dreams.
Rocking the brass, taping of the hands, lacing the gloves, the bucket in the corner. I made my way and my cut man's ready. I set my prayers and now it's time to go to war.
My father, in back of our home, he had a gym, a boxing gym. And it was our garage that he actually made into a boxing gym. And because I was like 8 years old, he wouldn't allow me in there because it's a man's sport. And the guys would walk around their shorts. And he just did not allow me in there. So what I did, I made two holes on the wall. And I would sit in my milk crate. And I made the holes right where the ring was so I could see him spar, because that's what I love to see, the sparring. So that's where that song started from.
But your father wouldn't let you in. I mean, he wouldn't let you even think about boxing, I suppose. What was it about the sport that really appealed to you?
I like the art of it. There is an art that you have to know, is how to execute a punch correctly. It's just a demanding sport as far as you really have to be in shape. So what I liked about it is all the routine of hitting the speed bag, hitting the heavy bag, jumping rope, shadow boxing, all that, because I'm sports oriented, and that's what I liked about it.
There's also all sorts of different people in there, I guess. You can, you don't have to be the strongest guy. You don't have to be a mountain. You can learn to box. And
yeah, I've always said that you could get a skinny guy at the same weight and get a guy that's muscular. And if you have the brains, you can beat him. Even if you don't have the punch that the other guy has, but if you have those brains and can box him and jab, and once you see him coming into you, just use your jab and move around him and throw your combinations and move. And if you have the condition, you can do that and you can win. And that's what my dad instilled in me, and I seen that with my own eyes.
That's a lesson you can take into a lot of other activities too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Condition is everything.
You sing in that song that boxing was a ticket to riches and fame. Was that also part of the appeal, do you think?
Yes, it is, because A lot of the fighters, or kids, I should say, because I worked with a lot of kids for 18 years, a lot of them come from poverty. They come from the projects, not all of them, but a good number of them.
I got love for you. Your words are your reason. I got love for you.
So my dad and I, our idea was to keep them out of gangs. So 2 hours that we'd spend with them at the gym every day was better than them being out, you know, graffitiing the walls or getting into some trouble. So I just felt that that was the thing to do for kids in the neighborhood. I would tell them, you know, this is a good way for you to make money as you grow older if you decide not to go to college. Of course, when I train kids, and like every year I would take 10 kids to Hawaii. And my purpose of that was this. I knew that their families would never afford, I shouldn't say never, but couldn't afford to take them to see that part of the island, because I always thought Hawaii was beautiful. And so I would do a fundraiser with my band at our gym and have two dances, save that money because I needed $5,000 to take 10 kids, okay? And I would take them. And my whole idea was that maybe these kids that saw this would say to themselves, hey, when I get married and get older, I would like to bring my wife here, or I would like to bring my parents here because I got to see this beautiful place. That was my theory of taking them somewhere like that. Mm-hmm. So I did it for like 5 years. And the last year, I even took Oscar De La Hoya. He was on the team to go with us, and his dad and himself was so appreciative, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I saw him at a book signing, and in my book, he signed, "Thank you so much for the inspiration you gave me."
It's very nice.
So
yeah.
That, to me, was a wonderful, and he was so happy to see me. I hadn't seen him in a numerous years, you know. And that's rewarding because he said, I'll never forget what you did for me and what you did for the kids in the community.
That's really nice.
So that itself is rewarding.
Do you think if you were that age now, when it is possible for girls to box, do you think you would have maybe pursued a career?
I would have been a champion. I would have been a champion. I know I would have. I'll tell you why. The four professional fights I had four knockouts. Okay. Now, because the girls that were starting, they can throw a jab, but I can honestly say there's a correct way of throwing a jab. You know, you have defense and offense. Now, my dad would teach defense with offense, or offense with defense, I should say. And what happened when I competed, I can throw a combination of five punches. The girls, they can only throw a jab and a right. And then they were lucky if they kept their hands up. So I had been doing this for many years before I got in that ring. So I know for a fact, and I know that I hit pretty hard. So I know that I feel that in these days, you know, I could have probably fought Ali. I could have fought the other girl. What's her name? Though I don't know if I would have fought them, only because my weight was low. I was 125, 30 pounder.
It must have given you a lot of self-confidence to do this, too. I was thinking that there's a song on the album, En El Tambo.
That's a prison song.
Right, but I'm thinking about a woman going into a prison and performing. You must have had...
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, like when you hear those doors close behind you, that's an eerie feeling, you know. I used to tell the guys in the band, I said, oh, it's a men's jail, not a women's, so I know they can't keep me or mistake me for one of them, but they could you. they would get all afraid. They were afraid. But it's an eerie feeling to have that door closed behind you. That's why in El Tambo, you know, in part of the song, it even mentions that.
Singing's always been a passion for me. I've done it all my life. I've been blessed with opportunities in this business of strife. In my days with El Chicano, we felt the responsibility. Along with doing concerts, we played some correctional facility.
En El Tambo, es una aventura. En El Tambo, la vida es muy dura.
In our travels, we did a show at Tehachapi State Pen. Pretty nervous being the only woman in a sea of men. Arriving there, we met at the gate by inmates who let us in. Nothing sounds quite the same as those gates closing the city of sin.
En el tambo es una aventura. En el tambo la vida es muy dura.
Mickey was always with me. I forever knew he had my back. And he made approach and ask if I had a cousin here.
It hit me like a stack of books upside my head.
There's a variety on this disc as well. They're not all the same thing. There's a very beautiful song called Mi India.
Papacito de mi vida. Papacito de mi vida. Papacito. Como te extraño.
Tell me about that one.
Well, that's how I feel or felt about my father, or feel, actually, because I still feel that way, even though I don't have him any longer. I shared a lot of good memories. I didn't have no bad memories with him growing up. I had a beautiful childhood. You know, I just wish that I would have recorded this song when he was living so he can hear it, you know.
This is what he used to call you?
Yes. He called me his Indian, you know, because my dad was half Indian. So he called me Mi India, you know. And he would always tell me, you know, obey me and hazme caso. You know, that's what the song says. So, and just, you know, how I felt about him is what I wrote about him.
Ursi Arvizu with a song called Mi India. It's from her debut solo album, Friend for Life, which was produced by Rai Cooter. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 629A, Save the Mails. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon and Veronica Rickard, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strain Champs, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.